This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents A Piece of the World, a novel, by Christina Baker Klein, performed by Polly Stone. There was a very strange connection, one of those odd collisions that happen. We were a little alike. I was an unhealthy child that was kept at home. So there was an unsaid feeling between us that was wonderful, an utter naturalness. We'd sit for hours and not say a word, and then she'd say something, and I'd answer her. A reporter once asked her what we talked about. She said, "Nothing foolish." Andrew Wyeth. Prologue. Later, he told me he'd been afraid to show me the painting. He thought I wouldn't like the way he portrayed me. Dragging myself across the field, fingers clutching dirt, my legs twisted behind. The arid moonscape of wheatgrass and timothy. That dilapidated house in the distance, looming up like a secret that won't stay hidden. Faraway windows, opaque and unreadable. Ruts in the spiky grass made by an invisible vehicle leading nowhere. Dishwater sky. People think the painting is a portrait, but it isn't, not really. He wasn't even in the field. He conjured it from a room in the house, an entirely different angle. He removed rocks and trees and outbuildings. The scale of the barn is wrong. And I am not that frail young thing, but a middle-aged spinster. It's not my body, really, and maybe not even my head. He did get one thing right. Sometimes a sanctuary, sometimes a prison. That house on the hill has always been my home. I've spent my life yearning toward it, wanting to escape it, paralyzed by its hold on me. There are many ways to be crippled, I've learned over the years, many forms of paralysis. My ancestors fled to Maine from Salem, but like anyone who tries to run away from the past, they brought it with them. Something inexorable seeds itself in the place of your origin. You can never escape the bonds of family history, no matter how far you travel. And the skeleton of a house can carry in its bones the marrow of all that came before. "Who are you, Christina Olson?" he asked me once. Nobody had ever asked me that. I had to think about it for a while. "If you really want to know me," I said, "we'll have to start with the witches, and then the drowned boys, the shells from distant lands, a whole room full of them, the Swedish sailor marooned in ice. I'll need to tell you about the false smiles of the Harvard man, and the hand-wringing of those brilliant Boston doctors, the dory in the haymow, and the wheelchair in the sea. And eventually, though neither of us knew it yet, we'd end up here, in this place, within and without the world of the painting." The Stranger at the Door. 1939. I'm working on a quilt patch in the kitchen on a brilliant July afternoon. Small squares of fabric and a pincushion and scissors on the table beside me. When I hear the hum of a car engine, looking out the window toward the cove, I see a station wagon turn into the field about 100 yards away. The engine cuts off and the passenger door swings open and Betsy James gets out, laughing and exclaiming. I haven't seen her since last summer. She's wearing a white halter top and denim shorts, a red bandana tied around her neck. As I watch her coming toward the house, I am struck by how different she looks. Her sweet round face has thinned and lengthened. Her chestnut hair is long and thick around her shoulders, her eyes dark and shining. A red slash of lipstick. I think of her at 9 years old, when she first came to visit, her small, nimble fingers braiding my hair as she sat behind me on the stoop. And here she is, 17 and suddenly a woman.
"Hey there, Christina,"
she says at the screen door, out of breath. It's been such a long time.
Come in, I say from my chair. You won't mind if I don't get up?
Of course not.
When she steps inside, the room smells of roses. When did Betsy start wearing perfume? She sweeps over to my chair and hugs my shoulders.
We arrived a few days ago. I surely am happy to be back.
You surely look it. She smiles, spots of color on her cheeks.
How are you now?
Oh, you know, fine, the same.
The same is good, yes?
I smile. Sure, the same is good.
What are you making here?
Just a little thing, a baby quilt. Laura's pregnant again.
Such a generous auntie.
She reaches down and picks up a quilt square, a piece of calico, pink flowers with green leaves on a brown background.
I recognize this fabric.
I tore up an old dress.
I remember it. Small white buttons and a full skirt, right?
I think of my mother bringing home the Butterick pattern and the iridescent buttons and the calico. I think of Walton seeing me in the dress for the first time. I am awed by you. That was a long time ago.
Well, it's nice that old dress is getting a new life.
Gently, she places the square back on the table and sifts through the others. White muslin, navy cotton, chambray faintly marked with ink.
All these bits and pieces. You're making a family heirloom.
I don't know about that, I say. It's just a pile of scraps.
One man's trash.
She laughs and glances out the window.
I completely forgot. I came up here for a cup of water, if you don't mind.
Sit down. I'll get you a glass.
Oh, it's not for me.
She points at the station wagon in the field.
My friend wants to paint a picture of your house, but he needs water to do it.
I squint at the car. A boy is sitting on the roof, looking at the sky. He's got a large white pad of paper in one hand and what looks like a pencil in the other.
He's N.C. Wyeth's son,
Betsy says in a stage whisper, as if someone might hear.
Who? You know N.C. Wyeth, the famous illustrator. Treasure Island?
Ah, Treasure Island. Al loved that book. I think we still have it somewhere.
I think every boy in America has it somewhere. Well, his son's an artist, too. I just met him today.
You met him today, and you're riding around in a car with him?
Yes, he's, I don't know. He seems trustworthy.
Your parents don't mind?
They don't know.
She smiles sheepishly.
He showed up at the house this morning looking for my father, but my parents had gone off for a sail. I answered the door, and here we are.
That happens sometimes, I say.
Pennsylvania. His family has a summer place up here in Port Clyde.
You seem to know an awful lot about him, I say, arching an eyebrow. She arches an eyebrow back.
I plan to learn more.
Betsy leaves with her cup of water and makes her way back to the station wagon. By the way she's walking, shoulders back and chin forward, I can tell she knows he's watching her. And she likes it. She hands the boy the cup and climbs onto the roof next to him.
Who was that?
My brother Al is at the back door, wiping his hands on a rag. I can never tell when he's coming. He's as quiet as a fox. Betsy, and a boy. He's painting a picture of the house, she said.
Why would he want to do that?
I shrug. People are funny.
Sure are.
Al settles into his rocker, pulling out his pipe and tobacco. He starts tamping and lighting, both of us spying on Betsy and the boy out the window and trying to act like we aren't. After a while, the boy climbs down and sets his pad of paper on the hood of the car. He offers his hand to Betsy, who slides down into his embrace. Even from this distance, I can feel the heat between them. They stand there talking for a minute, and then Betsy tugs on his hand, pulling him toward... Oh, Lord, she's bringing him up to the house. I feel a momentary panic. The floor is dusty. My dress soiled. My hair unkempt. Al's overalls are splashed with mud. It's been a long time since I've worried about being seen through the eyes of a stranger.
As they walk toward the house, though, I see the boy gazing at Betsy and realize I don't need to worry. She is all he sees. He's at the screen now, on the threshold, lanky, smiling, quivering with energy. He fills the entire doorway.
"What a marvelous house,"
he murmurs as he opens the screen, craning his neck to look up and around the room. "The light in here is extraordinary."
"Christina, Alvaro, this is Andrew,"
Betsy says, coming in behind him. He inclines his head. "Hope you don't mind my crashing in uninvited. Betsy swore it was okay."
"We don't stand on ceremony," my brother says. "I'm Al.
People after my own heart. And call me Andy, please."
"Well, I'm Christina," I say.
"I call her Christy, but no one else does,"
Al adds.
"Christina, then," Andy says, settling his gaze on me.
I detect no judgment in it, only a kind of anthropological curiosity. Still, his keen attention makes me blush. Turning to Al, I say quickly,
"Remember that book, Treasure Island? His father did the paintings for it," Betsy said.
"Did he now?"
Al's face lights up.
"You can't forget those pictures. I probably read that book a dozen times. Might be the only book I ever actually finished, now that I think about it. I wanted to be a pirate."
Andy breaks into a grin. His teeth are large and white, like a movie star's.
"So did I. Still do, in fact."
Betsy's holding the oversized drawing pad. As proud as a new mother, she brings it over to show me.
"Look what Andy did, Christina, in that short amount of time."
The paper is still damp. In bold strokes, Andy reduced the house to a white box with two gables facing the sea. The fields are green and yellow, with bristly blades of grass poking up here and there, near black firs, a purple swipe of mountains, watery clouds. Though the watercolor has been done quickly, there's movement in the brushstrokes, as if the wind is blowing through. It's clear this boy knows what he's doing. The windows are mere suggestions, but you have the peculiar sense that you can see inside. The house seems rooted in the earth.
"It's just a sketch," Andy says, coming up beside me.
"I'll keep working at it."
"Looks like a nice place to live," I say.
The house is snug and cozy, a fairy tale version of the one Al and I actually live in, the only hint of its decay in smudges of blue and brown. Andy laughs.
"You tell me."
Running two fingers over the paper, he says, "Such stark lines. There's something about this place. You've lived here a long time?" I nod. I sense that it's a place filled with stories. I'll bet I could paint it for 100 years and never get tired of it.
"Oh, you'd get tired of it,"
Al says. We all laugh. Andy claps his hands together.
"Hey, guess what? Today is my birthday."
"Is it really?"
Betsy asks.
"You didn't tell me."
He puts his arm around her and tugs her toward him.
"Didn't I? I feel like you know everything about me already."
"Not yet,"
she says.
"What's your age?"
I ask him.
22.
22? Betsy's only 17.
"A mature 17,
Betsy blurts, color rising to her cheeks. Andy seems amused.
"Well, I've never cared much about age or maturity."
"How are you going to celebrate?" I ask. He raises an eyebrow at Betsy.
"I'd say I'm celebrating right now."
Betsy doesn't show up again until several weeks later, when she bursts into the kitchen and practically dances across the floor.
"Christina, we are engaged,"
she says breathlessly, clasping my hand.
"Engaged?"
She nods.
"Can you believe it?"
"You're so young," I start to say. "It's too quick. You hardly know each other." Then I think of my own life. All the years, all the waiting that led to nothing. I saw how the two of them were together. The spark between them. I feel like you know everything about me already.
Of course you are, I say.
10 months later, a postcard arrives. Betsy and Andy are married. When they return to Maine for the summer, I hand Betsy a wedding gift. 2 pillowcases I made and embroidered with flowers. It took me 4 days to make the French knots for the daisies and the tiny buttonhole stitch leaves. My hands, stiff and gnarled, don't work the way they used to. Betsy looks closely at the embroidery and holds the pillowcases to her chest.
I will treasure these. They're perfect.
I give her a smile. They're not perfect. The lines are uneven. The flower petals spiky and overlarge. The cotton is marked faintly with the residue of ripped stitches. Betsy has always been kind. She shows me photographs from their upstate New York wedding ceremony. Andy in a tuxedo. Betsy in white with gardenias in her hair, both beaming with joy. After their 5-day honeymoon, she tells me, she'd assumed they would drive to Canada for the wedding of a close friend, but Andy said he had to get back to work.
He'd told me before we were married that was how it would be, she says. But I didn't quite believe it until that moment.
So did you go by yourself? She shakes her head.
I stayed with him. This is what I signed up for. The work is everything.
Out the kitchen window, I see Andy trudging up the field toward the house. Hitching one leg forward, dragging the other, his gait uneven. Strange that I didn't notice that before. Here he is at the door in paint-flecked boots, a white cotton shirt rolled to the elbow, a sketch pad under his arm. He knocks, 2 firm raps, and pulls open the screen. Betsy has some errands to do. Is it okay if I hang around? I try to act nonchalant, but my heart is racing. I can't remember the last time I was alone with a man other than Al. Suit yourself. He steps inside. He's taller and more handsome than I remember, with sandy brown hair and piercing blue eyes. There's something equine about the way he tosses his head and shifts his feet, a pulsating thrum. In the shell room, he runs his hand along the mantelpiece, brushing off the dust. Picks up Mother's cracked white teapot and turns it around. Cups my grandmother's chambered nautilus in his hand, and leafs through the filmy pages of her old black Bible. No one has opened my poor drowned Uncle Alvaro's sea chest in decades. It screeches when he lifts the lid. Andy picks up a shell-framed portrait of Abraham Lincoln, looks at it closely, sets it down. You can feel the past in this house, he says. The layers of generations. It reminds me of the House of the 7 Gables. So much of mankind's varied experience had passed there that the very timbers were oozy, as with the moisture of a heart. The lines are familiar. I remember reading that novel in school a long time ago. We're actually related to Nathaniel Hawthorne, I tell him. Interesting. Ah, yes, Hawthorne. Going to the window, he gestures toward the field. I saw the tombstones in the graveyard down there. Hawthorne lived in Maine for a while, I believe. I don't know about that, I admit. Our ancestors came from Massachusetts. Nearly 200 years ago. 3 men, in the middle of winter. Where in Massachusetts? Salem. Why'd they come up? My grandmother said they were trying to escape the taint of association with their relative John Hawthorne. He was Chief Justice of the witch trials. When they got to Maine, they dropped the E at the end of the name. To obscure the connection? I shrug. Presumably. I'm remembering this now, he says. Nathaniel Hawthorne left Salem too, and also changed the spelling of the name. But a lot of his stories are reworkings of his own family history. Your family history, I suppose. Moral allegories about people determined to root out wickedness in others while denying it in themselves. Actually, I tell him, there's a legend that as one of the condemned witches stood at the scaffold, waiting for the noose, she uttered a curse, May God take revenge on the family of John Hawthorne.
So your family is cursed,
he says with delight. Maybe. Who knows? My grandmother used to say that those Hawthorne men brought the witches with them from Salem. She kept the door open between the kitchen and the shed for the witches to come and go. Looking around the shell room, he says, what do you think? Is it true? I've never seen any, I tell him. But I keep the door open, too. Over the years, certain stories in the history of a family take hold. They're passed from generation to generation, gaining substance and meaning along the way. You have to learn to sift through them, separating fact from conjecture, the likely from the implausible. Here is what I know. Sometimes, the least believable stories are the true ones. 1896 to 1900. My mother drapes a wrung-out cloth across my forehead. Cold water trickles down my temple onto the pillow, and I turn my head to smear it off. I gaze up into her gray eyes, narrowed in concern, a vertical line between them. Small lines around her puckered lips. I look over at my brother Alvaro standing beside her, 2 years old, eyes wide and solemn. She pours water from a white teapot into a glass. Drink, Christina. Smile at her, Katie. My grandmother Trofina tells her, fear is a contagion. She leads Alvaro out of the room, and my mother reaches for my hand, smiling with only her mouth. I am 3 years old. My bones ache. When I close my eyes, I feel like I'm falling. It's not an altogether unpleasant sensation, like sinking into water. Colors behind my eyelids, purple and rust. My face so hot that my mother's hand on my cheek feels icy. I take a deep breath, inhaling the smells of wood smoke and baking bread, and I drift. The house creaks and shifts. Snoring in another room, the ache in my bones drives me back to the surface. When I open my eyes, I can't see anything, but I can tell my mother is gone. I'm so cold it feels like I've never been warm. My teeth chattering loudly in the quiet. I hear myself whimpering, and it's as if the sound is coming from someone else. I don't know how long I've been making this noise, but it makes me feel better. Distraction from the pain. The covers lift. My grandmother says, there, Christina, hush, I'm here. She slides into bed beside me in her thick flannel nightgown and pulls me toward her. I settle into the curve of her legs, her bosom pillowy behind my head, her soft fleshy arm under my neck. She rubs my cold arms, and I fall asleep in a warm cocoon smelling of talcum powder and linseed oil and baking soda. Since I can remember, I've called my grandmother Mame. It's the name of a tree that grows in the West Indies, where she went with my grandfather, Captain Sam Hawthorne, on one of their many excursions. The Mame tree has a short, thick trunk, and only a few large limbs and pointy green leaves, with white flowers at the ends of the branches, like hands. It blooms all year long, and its fruit ripens at different times. When my grandparents spent several months on the island of St. Lucia, my grandmother made jam out of the fruit, which tastes like an overripe raspberry. The riper it gets, the sweeter it gets, like me, she said. Don't call me Granny. Mame suits me just fine. Sometimes I find her sitting alone, gazing out the window in the shell room, our front parlor, where we display the treasures that six generations of sailors brought home in sea chests from their voyages around the world. I know she's pining for my grandfather, who died in this house a year before I was born. It is a terrible thing to find the love of your life, Christina, she says. You know too well what you're missing when it's gone. You have us, I say.
I loved your grandfather more than all the shells in the shell room, she says. More than all the blades of grass in the field.
My grandfather, like his father and grandfather before him, began his life on the sea as a cabin boy and became a ship captain. After marrying my grandmother, he took her with him on his travels, transporting ice from Maine to the Philippines, Australia, Panama, the Virgin Islands, and filling the ship for the return trip with brandy, sugar, spices, and rum. Her stories of their exotic travels have become family legend. She traveled with him for decades, even bringing along their children, three boys and a girl, until, at the height of the Civil War, he insisted they stay home. Confederate privateers were prowling up and down the East Coast like marauding pirates, and no ship was immune. But my grandfather's caution could not keep his family safe. All three of his boys died young. One succumbed to scarlet fever. His four-year-old namesake Sammy drowned one October when he was at sea. My grandmother could not bring herself to break the news until March. "Our beloved little boy is no more on earth," she wrote. "While I write, I'm almost blind with tears. No one saw him fall but the little boy who ran to tell his mother. The vital spark has fled. Dear husband, you can better imagine my grief than I can describe to you." 14 years later, their teenaged son Alvaro, working as a seaman on a schooner off the coast of Cape Cod, was swept overboard in a storm. News of his death came by telegram, blunt and impersonal. His body was never found. Alvaro's sea chest arrived on Hawthorne Point weeks later, its top intricately carved by his hand. My grandmother, disconsolate, spent hours tracing the outlines with her fingertips. Damsels in hoop skirts, with revealing décolletage. My bedroom is still and bright. Light filters through the lace curtains Mamet crocheted, making intricate shapes on the floor. Dust motes float in slow motion. Stretching out in the bed, I lift my arms from under the sheet. No pain. I'm afraid to move my legs. Afraid to hope that I'm better. My brother Alvaro swings into the room, hanging on to the doorknob. He stares at me blankly, then shouts, to no one in particular, "Christy's awake!" He gives me a long, steady look as he closes the door. I hear him clomping deliberately down the stairs, and then my mother's voice and my grandmother's, the clash of pots far away in the kitchen, and I drift back to sleep. Next thing I know, Al is shaking my shoulder with his spider-monkey hand, saying, "Wake up, lazy!" And Mother, trundling through the door with her big pregnant belly, is setting a tray on the round oak table beside the bed. Oatmeal mush and toast and milk. My father a shadow behind her. For the first time in I don't know how long, I feel a pang that must be hunger. Mother smiles a real smile as she props two pillows behind my head and helps me sit up. Spoons oatmeal into my mouth. Waits for me to swallow between slurps. Al says, "Why are you feeding her? She's not a baby." And Mother tells him to hush. But she is laughing and crying at the same time, tears rolling down her cheeks, and has to stop for a moment to wipe her face with her apron.
"Why are you crying, Mama?"
Al asks.
"Because your sister is going to get well."
I remember her saying this. But it will be years before I understand what it means. It means my mother was afraid I might not get well. They were all afraid. All except Alvaro and me and the unborn baby, each of us busy growing, unaware of how bad things could get. But they knew. My grandmother, with her three dead children. My mother, the only one who survived. Her childhood threaded with melancholy. Who named her firstborn son after her brother who drowned in the sea. A day passes. Another. A week. I am going to live. But something isn't right. Lying in the bed, I feel like a rag wrung out and draped to dry. I can't sit up, can barely turn my head. I can't move my legs. My grandmother settles into a chair beside me with her crocheting, looking at me now and then over the top of her rimless spectacles.
There, child. Rest is good. Baby steps.
Christy's not a baby,
Al says. He's lying on the floor, pushing his green train engine.
She's bigger than me.
Yes, she's a big girl, but she needs rest so she can get better.
Rest is stupid,
Al says. He wants me back to normal so we can run to the barn, play hide-and-seek among the hay bales, poke at the gopher holes with a long stick. I agree. Rest is stupid. I am tired of this narrow bed, the slice of window above it. I want to be outside, running through the grass, climbing up and down the stairs. When I fall asleep, I am careening down the hill, my arms outstretched and my strong legs pumping, grasses whipping against my calves, steady on toward the sea, closing my eyes and tilting my chin toward the sun, moving with ease, without pain, without falling. I wake in my bed to find the sheet damp with sweat.
What's wrong with me? Why are my legs like this?
I ask my mother as she tucks a fresh sheet around me. You are as God made you.
Why would he make me like this?
Her eyelids flicker. Not quite a flutter, but a startled blink and long shut eye that I've come to recognize. It's the expression she makes when she doesn't know what to say. We have to trust in his plan. My grandmother, crocheting in her chair, doesn't say anything. But when Mother goes downstairs with the dirty sheets, she says,
Life is one trial after another. You're just learning that earlier than most.
But why am I the only one?
She laughs.
Oh, child, you're not the only one.
She tells me about a sailor in their crew with one leg, who thumped around deck on a wooden dowel. Another with a hunchback that made him scuttle like a crab. One born with six fingers on each hand.
How quickly that boy could tie knots.
One with a foot like a cabbage. One with scaly skin like a reptile. Conjoined twins she once saw on the street. People have maladies of all kinds, she says. And if they have any sense, they don't waste time whining about it.
We all have our burdens to bear, she says. You know what yours is now. That's good. You'll never be surprised by it.
Mame tells me a story about when she and Captain Sam were shipwrecked in a storm. Cast adrift on a precarious raft in the middle of the ocean, shivering and alone, with scant provisions. The sun set and rose. Their food and water dwindled. They despaired that they would never be rescued. She tore strips of clothing, tied them to an oar, and managed to prop this wretched flag upright. For weeks, they saw no one. They licked their salt-cracked lips and closed their sunburned lids, resigning themselves to their all but certain fates, blessed unconsciousness and death. And then, one evening near sundown, a speck on the horizon materialized into a ship heading directly toward them, drawn by the fluttering rags.
The most important qualities a human can possess are an iron will and a persevering spirit,
Mame says.
She says I inherited those qualities from her, and that in the same way she survived the shipwreck when all hope was lost, and the deaths of her three boys when she thought her heart might pulverize like a shell into sand, I will find a way to keep going, no matter what happens. Most people aren't as lucky as I am, she says, to come from such hardy stock.
She was fine until the fever,
Mother tells Dr. Heald, as I sit on the examining table in his Cushing office.
Now she can barely walk.
He pokes and prods, draws blood, takes my temperature.
Let's see here,
he says, grasping my legs. He probes my skin with his fingers, feeling his way down my legs to the bones in my feet.
Yes, he murmurs. Irregularities. Interesting.
Grasping my ankles, he tells my mother,
It's hard to say. The feet are deformed. I suspect it's viral. I recommend braces. No guarantee they'll work, but probably worth a try.
My mother presses her lips together. What's the alternative? Dr. Heald winces in an exaggerated way, as if this is as hard for him to say as it is for us to hear.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think there is one.
The braces Dr. Heald puts me in clamp my legs like a medieval torture device, tearing my skin into bloody strips and making me howl in pain. After a week of this, Mother takes me back to Dr. Heald and he removes them. She gasps when she sees my legs, covered with red, festering wounds. To this day, I bear the scars. For the rest of my life, I will be wary of doctors. When Dr. Heald comes to the house to check on Mame or Mother's pregnancy or Papa's cough, I make myself scarce, hiding in the attic, the barn, the four-hole privy in the shed. On the pine boards of the kitchen floor, I practice walking in a straight line. 1 foot in front of the next, like a tightrope walker, my mother instructs. Along the seam. It's hard to keep my balance. I can only walk on the outsides of my feet. If this really were a tightrope in the circus, Al points out, I would have fallen to my death a dozen times already. Steady now, Mother says. It's not a race.
It is a race,
Al says. On a parallel seam, he steps lightly in a precise choreography of small, stockinged feet, and within moments is at the end. He throws up his arms.
I win!
I pretend to stumble, and as I fall, I kick his legs out from under him, and he lands hard on his tailbone.
Get out of her way, Alvaro,
Mother scolds. Sprawling on the floor, he glowers at me. I glower back. Al is thin and strong, like a strip of steel, or the trunk of a sapling. He is naughtier than I am, stealing eggs from the hens and attempting to ride the cows. I feel a pit of something hard and spiky in my stomach. Jealousy. Resentment. And something else. The unexpected pleasure of revenge. I fall so often that Mother sews cotton pads for my elbows and knees. No matter how much I practice, I can't get my legs to move the way they should. But eventually they're strong enough that I can play hide-and-seek in the barn and chase chickens in the yard. Al doesn't care about my limp. He tugs at me to come with him, climb trees, ride Dandy the old brown mule, scrounge for firewood for a clam bake. Mother's always scolding and shushing him to go away, give me peace. But Mame is silent. She thinks it's good for me, I can tell. I wake in the dark to the sound of rain drumming the roof and a commotion in my parents' bedroom. Mother groaning, Mame murmuring, my father's voice, and two others I don't recognize in the foyer downstairs. I slip out of bed and into my woolen skirt and thick socks, and cling to the rail as I half fall, half slide down the stairs. At the bottom, my father is standing with a stout, red-faced woman wearing a kerchief over her frizzy hair.
Go back to bed, Christina, Papa says. It's the middle of the night.
Babies pay no attention to the clock,
the woman sing-songs. She shrugs off her coat and hands it to my father. I cling to the banister while she lumbers like a badger up the narrow stairs. I creep up after her and push open the door to Mother's bedroom. Mame is there, leaning over the bed. I can't see much on the high mahogany four-poster, but I hear Mother moaning. Mame turns.
Oh, child, she says with dismay, this is no place for you.
It's all right. A girl needs to learn the ways of the world sooner or later,
the badger says.
She jerks her head at me.
Why don't you make yourself useful? Tell your father to heat water on the stove.
I look at Mother, thrashing and writhing.
Is she going to be all right?
The badger scowls.
Your mother is fine and dandy. Did you hear what I said? Boiling water. Baby's on the way.
I make my way down to the kitchen and tell Papa, who puts a pot of water on the black iron Glenwood range. As we wait in the kitchen, he teaches me card games, blackjack and crazy eights, to pass the time. The sound of the wind, driving rain against the house, is like dry beans in a hollow stick. Before morning is over, we hear the high-pitched cry of a healthy baby. His name is Samuel, Mother says when I climb onto the bed beside her.
Isn't he perfect?
I say, though I think the baby looks as crabapple-faced as the badger.
Maybe he'll be an explorer like his grandfather Samuel, Mamay says. Like all of the seafaring Samuels.
God forbid, Mother says.
Who are the seafaring Samuels? I ask Mamay later, when Mother and the baby are napping and we're alone in the shell room.
They're your ancestors. The reason you're here, she says.
She tells me the story of how in 1743, three men from Massachusetts, two brothers, Samuel and William Hawthorne, and William's son Alexander, packed their belongings into three carriages for the long journey to the province of Maine in the middle of winter. They arrived at a remote peninsula that for 2,000 years had been a meeting ground for Indian tribes, and built a tent made of animal skins, sturdy enough to withstand the coming months of snow and ice and muddy thaw. Within a year they felled a swath of forest and built three log cabins, and they gave this spit of land in Cushing, Maine, a name, Hawthorne Point. 50 years later, Alexander's son Samuel, a sea captain, built a two-story wood-frame house on the foundation of the family's cabin. Samuel married twice, raised 6 children in the house, and died in his 70s. His son Aaron, also a sea captain, married twice and raised 8 children here. When Aaron died and his widow decided to sell the house, opting for a simpler life in town, closer to the bakery and the dry goods store, the seafaring Hawthornes were dismayed. 5 years later, Aaron's son, Samuel IV, bought the house back, re-establishing the family's hold on the land. Samuel IV was my grandfather. All of those sea captains, coming and going for months at a time, their many wives and children, up and down the narrow stairs. To this day, Mamay says, this old house on Hawthorne Point is filled with their ghosts. When your world is small, you learn every inch of it. You can trace it in the dark. You navigate it in your sleep. Fields of rough grass sloping toward the rocky shore and the sea beyond. Nooks and crannies to hide and play in. The soot-black range, always warm in the kitchen. Geraniums on the windowsill, splayed red like a magician's handkerchief. Feral cats in the barn. Air that smells of pine and seaweed, of chicken roasting in the oven and freshly plowed soil. One summer afternoon, Mother looks at the tide chart in the kitchen and says, "Put on your shoes, Christina. I've got something to show you." I lace up my brown brogues and follow her down through the field, past the humming cicadas and the swooping crows, and into the family cemetery, my legs steady enough that I can almost keep up. I trail my fingers across the moss-mottled, half-crumbled headstones, their etchings hard to read. The oldest one belongs to Joanne Smalley Hawthorne. She died in 1834, when she was 33, the mother of 7 young children. When she was dying, Mother tells me, she begged her husband to bury her on the property instead of in the town cemetery several miles away so their children could visit her grave. Her children were buried here too. All the Hawthornes after her are buried here. We continue to the shore on the southern side of Hawthorne Point, above Kissing Cove and Maple Juice Cove, where the estuary of the St. George River flows into Muskongus Bay and the Atlantic Ocean beyond. There's an ancient heap of shells here that Mother says was left by Abenaki Indians who spent long ago summers on the point. I try to envision what it would have been like here before this house was built, before the three log cabins, before any settlers discovered it. I imagine an Abenaki girl, like me, scouring the rocky shore for shells. From the point, you can see way out to sea. Did she keep one eye on the horizon, scanning it for intruders? Did she have any idea how much her life would change when they arrived? The tide is low. I stumble on the rocks, but Mother doesn't say anything, just stops and waits. Across the muddy flats is Little Island, an acre-wide wilderness of birches and dry grass. She points to it. We're going there, but we can't stay long or the tide will strand us. Our path is an obstacle course of seaweed-slick stones. I pick my way along slowly, and even so I trip and fall, scraping my hand on a cluster of barnacles. My feet are damp inside my shoes. Mother glances back at me. Get up, we're nearly there. When we reach the island, she spreads a wool blanket on the beach where it's dry. Out of her rucksack, she takes an egg sandwich on thick sliced bread, a cucumber, two pieces of fried apple cake. She hands me half the sandwich. Close your eyes and feel the sun, she says, and I do, leaning back on my elbows, chin toward sky, eyelids warm and yellow, trees rustling behind us like starch-stiff skirts, briny air. Why would you want to be anywhere else? After we eat, we collect shells, pale green anemone puffs and iridescent purple mussels. Look, Mother says, pointing at a crab emerging from a tide pool, picking its way across the rocks. All of life is here in this place. In her own way, she is always trying to teach me something. To live on a farm is to wage an ongoing war with the elements, Mother says. We have to push back against the unruly outdoors to keep chaos at bay. Farmers work in the soil with mules and cows and pigs, and the house must be a sanctuary. If it isn't, we are no better than the animals. Mother is in constant motion, sweeping, mopping, scouring, baking, wiping, washing, hanging out sheets. She makes bread in the morning using yeast from the hop vine behind the shed. There's always a pot of porridge on the back of the range by the time I come downstairs, with a filmy skin on top that I poke through and feed to the cat when she isn't looking. Sometimes dry oatcakes and boiled eggs. Baby Sam sleeps in a cradle in the corner. When the breakfast dishes are cleared, she starts on the large midday meal, chicken pie or pot roast or fish stew, mashed or boiled potatoes, peas or carrots, fresh or canned, depending on the season. What's left over reappears at supper, transformed into a casserole or a stew. Mother sings while she works. Her favorite song, Red Wing, is about an Indian maiden pining for a brave who's gone to battle, growing more despondent as time passes. Tragically, her true love is killed. Now the moon shines tonight on pretty Red Wing. The breeze is sighing, the night birds crying. For afar neath his star her brave is sleeping, while Red Wing's weeping her heart away. It's hard for me to understand why Mother likes such a sad song. Mrs. Crowley, my teacher at the Wing School No. 4 in Cushing, says that the Greeks believed witnessing pain in art makes you feel better about your own life. But when I mention this to Mother, she shrugs. I just like the melody. It makes the housework go faster. As soon as I'm tall enough to reach the dining room table, my job is to set it. Mother teaches me how with the heavy silver plate cutlery. Fork on the left. L-E-F-T. Four letters, same as fork. F-O-R-K, she says, as she shows me, setting the fork beside the plate in its proper place. Knife and spoon on the right. Five letters, R-I-G-H-T, same as knife and spoon,
K-N-I-F-E.
S-P-O-O-N, I say.
Yes.
And glass, G-L-A-S-S, right?
What a clever one!
Mamay calls from the kitchen.
By the time I'm 7, I can strip thin ribbons of skin from potatoes with a knife, scrub the pine floors with bleach on my hands and knees, tend the hop vine behind the shed, culling yeast to make bread. Mother shows me how to sew and mend, and though my unruly fingers make it hard to thread a needle, I'm determined. I try again and again, pricking my forefinger, fraying the tip of the thread.
I've never seen such determination,
Mamay exclaims. But Mother doesn't say a word until I've succeeded in threading it. Then she says,
Christina, you are nothing if not tenacious.
Mamay doesn't share Mother's fear of dirt. What's the worst that can happen if dust collects in the corners or we leave dishes in the sink? Her favorite things are time-worn. The old Glenwood range. The rocking chair by the window with the fraying cane seat. The handsaw with a broken handle in a corner of the kitchen. Each one of them, she says, with its own story to tell.
Mamay runs her fingers along the shells on the mantelpiece in the shell room, like an archaeologist uncovering a ruin that springs to life with all the knowledge she holds about it. The shells she discovered in her son Alvaro's sea chest have pride of place here, alongside her black, travel-battered Bible. Pastel-colored shells of all shapes and sizes line the edges of the floor and the window ledges. Shell-encrusted vases, statues, tintypes, valentines, book covers. Miniature views of the family homestead on scallop shells, painted by a long-ago relative. Even a shell-framed engraving of President Lincoln. She hands me her prized shell, the one she found near a coral reef on a beach in Madagascar. It's surprisingly heavy, about 8 inches long, silky smooth, with a rust and white zebra stripe on top that melts into a creamy white bottom.
It's called a chambered nautilus, she says.
Nautilus is Greek for sailor.
She tells me about a poem in which a man finds a broken shell like this one on the shore. Noticing the spiral chambers enlarging in size, he imagines the mollusk inside getting larger and larger, outgrowing one space and moving on to the next.
Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll,
Mamay recites, spreading her hands in the air.
Till thou at length art free, leaving thine outgrown shell by life's unresting sea. It's about human nature, you see. You can live for a long time inside the shell you were born in, but one day it'll become too small.
Then what? I ask.
Well, then you'll have to find a larger shell to live in.
I consider this for a moment. What if it's too small, but you still want to live there?
She sighs. Gracious child, what a question. I suppose you'll either have to be brave and find a new home, or you'll have to live inside a broken shell.
Mamay shows me how to decorate book covers and vases with tiny shells, overlapping them so they cascade down in a precise flat line. As we glue the shells, she reminisces about my grandfather's bravery and adventurousness. How he outsmarted pirates and survived tidal waves and shipwrecks. She tells me again about the flag she made out of strips of cloth when all hope was lost and the miraculous sight of that faraway freighter that came to their rescue.
Don't fill the girl's head with those tall tales,
Mother scolds, overhearing from the pantry.
They're not tall tales, they're real life. You know you were there.
Mother comes to the door.
You make it all sound grand when you know it was miserable most of the time.
It was grand, Mamay says.
This girl may never go anywhere. She should at least know that adventure is in her bones.
When Mother leaves the room, shutting the door behind her, Mamay sighs. She says she can't believe she raised a child who traveled all over the world, but has been content ever since to let the world come to her. She says Mother would have been a spinster if Papa hadn't walked up the hill and given her an alternative. I know some of the story. That my mother was the only surviving child, and that she clung close to home. After my grandfather retired from the sea, he and Mamay decided to turn their house into a summertime inn for the income, the distraction from grief. They added a third floor with dormers, creating four more bedrooms in the now 16-room house, and placed ads in newspapers all along the eastern seaboard. Drawn by word of mouth about the charming inn and its postcard view, visitors streamed north. In the 1880s, a whole family could lodge at Hawthorne House for $12 a week, including meals. The inn was a lot of work, more than any of them anticipated, and my mother was needed to help run it. As the years passed, the few eligible bachelors in Cushing married or moved away. By the time she was in her mid-30s, she was well past the point, she thought, everyone thought, of meeting a man and falling in love. She would live in this house and take care of her parents until they were buried in the family plot between the house and the sea. "There's an old expression," Mamay tells me, "daughtering out. Do you know what it means?" I shake my head. "It means no male heirs survive to carry on the family name. Your mother is the last of the Cushing Hawthorns. When she dies, the Hawthorne name will die with her."
"There's still Hawthorne Point."
"Yes, that's true. But this is no longer Hawthorne House, is it? Now it's the Olsen House, named for a Swedish sailor 6 years younger than your mother."
My mind is reeling. Wait, Papa is younger than Mother?
"You didn't know that?" When I shake my head again, Mamay laughs. "There's a lot you don't know, child. Johan Olausen was his name then."
I mouth the strange words. Johan Olausen.
Barely spoke a word of English. He was a deckhand on a schooner captained by John Maloney, who lives in that little house down yonder with his wife, she says, gesturing toward the window. "You know who I'm talking about?"
I nod. The captain is a friendly man with a bushy gray mustache and yellow corn teeth, and his wife is a ruddy, broad-faced woman with a bosom that seems of a piece with her middle. I've seen his boat in the cove, the Silver Spray.
"Well, it was February, 1890, a bad winter. Endless. They were on their way to Thomaston from New York, delivering fuel wood and coal to lime kilns up there. But when they reached Muscongus Bay and dropped anchor, a storm swept in. It was so cold that ice grew around the ship in the night. There was nothing they could do. They were stranded. After a few days, when the ice was thick enough, they got out and walked across it to shore, this shore. Your father had nowhere to go, so he stayed with Maloney and his wife until the thaw."
"How long was that?"
"Oh, months."
"And the boat was just out there in the ice the whole time?"
"All winter long," she says. "You could see it from this window."
She lifts her chin toward the pantry. I can faintly hear the clatter of dishes on the other side of the door.
"Well, there he was, in that little cottage all winter, down near the cove, with a clear view of this house up the hill. He must have been bored to death, but he'd learned how to knit in Sweden. He made that blue wool blanket in the parlor while he was staying with them. Did you know that?"
"No."
"He did, sitting around the hearth with the Maloneys every night. Anyway, you know how people are. They talk, they tell stories, and oh, those Maloneys like to gossip. They would have told him, no doubt, about how this house was on the verge of daughtering out, and that if Katie married, her husband would inherit the whole thing. I don't know for sure, of course. I can only guess what was said. But he'd been here just a week when he decided he was going to learn English. He walked into town and asked Mrs. Crowley at the wing school to teach him."
"My teacher, Mrs. Crowley?"
"Yes, she was the teacher even then. He went to the schoolhouse every day for lessons. And before the ice thawed, he'd changed his name to John Olson.
Then, one day, he made his way up through the field to this house and knocked on the front door, and your mother answered. And that was it. Within a year, Captain Sam died, and your parents were